All right, thank you to the organizers and the hosts. The away team and the home team have done a great job, in my opinion. As you can see, this, first, not to forget to learn how to use this. Not to forget my collaborators. There we go. Oliver Ernst is a PhD student at UC San Diego. Corey Scott is a PhD student at UC Irvine. These are the more senior collaborators. Bob Bird is a new staff member at Los Alamos National Lab. Eric Medvedev has just started at UCI. Longstanding collaborator in plant biology is Elliot Meyerowitz, whose discussions entered in here, and Ray Whiteman helped me with some of the data. These funding sources, and of course KITP for hosting us, Center for Nonlinear Studies at Los Alamos, and actually a few years ago, Sainsbury Lab, Cambridge, helped me work on some of the work that I'll show here. unusually for this workshop, this is more a talk about methods, computational and mathematical. Here are all the domains that you should know very well in order to do that, so nobody can really do this, and maybe that's one of the arguments for computational aid. And my plan is to address very briefly the the advertisement for this workshop had to do with principles in biology. It's very ambitious to do that, so I won't do much of it. Then to talk about the two main methods that I'm trying to develop. One is machine learning for model reduction using dynamic Boltzmann distributions. And the other is an operator algebra of structures, dynamic structures, essentially meaning spatially embedded graphs as a sort of modeling language. And then a little bit of speculation, yet more speculation about the software architecture and mathematical architecture that might result. So I have a long list of potential biological principles, which I won't really read, but they divide into biophysical, scarce resources, not just energy, but also information and access, proximity. There are a lot of network-like principles going back to Amarger 1950, as far as I know. And then, of course, in physics, we're interested in the co-option of emergent physical properties. Adel and Leiser highlighted the use of modularity in plants for robustness, which maybe is more extreme but not exclusive to plants. then on the information side, people have talked a lot about information bottlenecks, spatial information flow, often information sort of by itself without considering its molecular substrate acts as a reactant, catalyst, or substrate or product. In our simplest conception of biological systems, the biological system doesn't know we're doing that. Internal representations are a big one, in my opinion. And an example in development would be positional information. And of course, the evolution of evolution and the evolution of sub-evolutions. Methodological, so I guess I did read it after all. Methodological points, although we should try to think through everything, we're really not smart enough to do it with comprehensively without the aid of computational simulations, models, which are, I think, are a superset, and analyses, which is another kind of model. I think that's not enough. And what we really need are stacks, hierarchical stacks of models that are related to different scales in a way that's defined mathematically, can be simulated, can be learned, that's part one, can be represented and transformed, that's part two, by symbolic means. So what are some examples of reduced models? obviously well-mixed mass action concentration models are very reduced. A standard kind of approach is partial differential equations. Even though your cell or tissue is made out of molecules, you still go to the continuum limit. That helps. Then these topological models that aren't really captured nicely by partial differential equations, cell-centered or vertex biomechanical models. Plants are a little different from animals, so this may be better. Then at greater detail, finite element, kind of multi-compartmental models. And then another standard method for reduction in physics is mean field theory and its more advanced versions, which is in some ways related to the learning method that I'll show you. And finally, there's these beautiful topological descriptions, such as those that Frank Ulicker showed, and the standard physics and bifurcation, phase transition bifurcation diagram. So maybe that sets up a space of models that reduced models and model reductions that we would love to represent in the computer and automate the process of, so that we could scale up to bigger and more complex systems, which we have. So first part, learning stochastic, reduced stochastic dynamics. In this case, the biological context is a collaboration with Terry Sanofsky's group and including Tom Bartol at the Salk Institute. And they have wonderful multi-scale models written in their M-cell simulation of what happens at a synapse. And not all of it yet. There's also sort of morphodynamics at a synapse with growing and shrinking that is not fully described. And depending on the scale you look at, there are a lot of different methods that could be used and are being used in that kind of project. So here's an example of a model reduction that we worked on a few years ago, where we're talking about the synapse's response to calcium input in a published model by Pepke et al., which is a rule-based model. So you have not just individual list of reactions, but they're parameterized reactions. In this case, you have calmodulin parameterized by how many calciums are bound at each end. So there's two integers there that each run from 0 to 2. So 3 values, 9 values total. And then calmodulin subunits can grab on to this. Camcanus 2 subunits can grab onto the time to the calmodulins and give you a new species, which is the Camcanus 2 with those calciums attached, then various other things happen. The calmodulins dimerize, the model ends there, but actually it goes on to form a hollow enzyme, which will possibly connect it, and there's a phosphorylation step in there, and so forth. So it's a rule-based model, which if you expanded it out would be a couple of thousand rules, but you can represent it in just a dozen of these high-level rules. But still, it's especially if you have the spatially distributed version of it. This is older work, by the way. Then we can make it's a big simulation, and we'd like to make a reduced model in terms of basically an easing-like model in which you have Boolean variables such as calcium bound or not bound that interact with each other by coefficients that are to be learned. And if you learn these coefficients, then you can approximate the state of the fine scale system at any moment in time. You can take a snapshot. What we really want to do is learn the dynamics of that. And so this is the setup for doing that. Fine scale is
this. Just a rough impression for a model such as that. What sort of data are you fitting to?
It's all simulation. So the data is coming from fine scale simulation run in M cell, for example, that computes for a long time, and we're trying to make a coarse scale approximation to that.
But then ultimately, there's some phenomena that you're hoping to model.
Yes, of course.
A sense of sort of on what scale that phenomena is that you could measure. Generally.
So here's an example where have calcium pulses coming in, and we want to know what the response of each of the downstream components is to that. And that's measurable.
So roughly how many parameters are in these many blocks?
So because of weight sharing, it's 7. So many of, oops, I keep hitting the wrong button, sorry. Many of these, like all of these interaction weights are the same, and all these are the same and so forth. So there's just, because of your intuition about the system, which is required, then in this case we have a small number of parameters. Yeah.
So this graph is based on intuition?
Yes, right. This is where you put in your physicist knowledge. Right, and so if you don't have any, then you can't do this.
Well, what happens if you just gave it like a more connected graph? You'd have more parameters, but like...
Yeah, you'd have more parameters, and what often, we didn't do that experiment, but often happens in machine learning is you get an ensemble of things that all behave the same way when you have enough training data, and if you add a lasso-like regularization on the weights, then some of the weights that weren't really necessary will get driven towards zero.
So you get this if you do that?
We have not done that experiment, but I invite you to try.
Sorry, Professor, I'm just trying to understand what I'm looking at.
Yeah.
Is there any way of arriving at number 7 by looking at this graph? Is it the number of distinct edges?
It's the number of distinct hexagons. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, like, I don't know where the 7th one is, but basically you hypothesize that these are different kinds of binary variables, including the dimerization at the end, and different ideas, and you put in your ideas of where the interaction should be.
So and the edges are interactions, and
the hexagons are the weights on the interactions in this diagram.
And there are some sort of dynamic. How many dynamical variables are there?
So dynamical
just one.
The next slide.
How many states of calmodulin are we trying to?
Describe, for example, the evolution of the average values of these Boolean variables. So how many time, what fraction of the time is one of the binding sites bound? What fraction of the time is the whole thing dimerized? What fraction of the time has the phosphorylation happened on each CAM kinase subunit? So just...
And so how many states on CAM kinase are we trying to describe? 1, 2, 3, 4, 7?
CAM kinase has... each cal modulin has 9 states potentially. You could reduce that by counting up the number instead of keeping track of them individually. So cam kinase itself then has all of those states for the cal modulin at bound, and it has a phosphorylation state and a state saying whether it dimerized or not. Okay.
So,
yep.
So you have 7 parameters in this like reduced model. How many parameters do you have in the full microscopic model?
I don't remember, but it's a huge it's quite a substantial model reduction. Like we went and compared it with a bunch of other model reductions in the literature that were getting 30% fewer parameters and so forth, and we were getting, I don't know, a factor of 2 or something like that. Quite a lot.
So could you reduce it to 3 parameters?
Well, we didn't try that either. You could try, but then you'd have to cut out. It would look to me like you'd have to cut out some of what you think are the key variables. It would sort of violate my physical intuition, but maybe not yours.
So going back to Eric's question, so roughly how much data is this trying to? Does the number of parameters relate in any way to how much data, different conditions that you're trying to describe?
I'm sorry, I just don't remember.
We
had megabytes of simulation results being shipped up from Salk to Irvine, but of course, how those exactly got reduced to mm-hmm. So the configurations that are being summarized and learned were large, but the final comparison of simulated with reduced model statistics was small. Okay. So the setup
this will be my last one. So let's say you had your microscopic system with like n variables, and then you built a model like the one you did based on intuition, but with this form. But it also had n variables.
Yeah.
Do you think you would perfectly describe all the data? Like,
eventually, yes. Of course, it depends. There's the potential for trouble is that.
So the
trouble is dynamics. The fine scale dynamics is given by a master equation, so it actually has more parameters in it than an energy function would have. It has rates in it. We're going to try to get those rates, summarize those rates, in terms of some differential equations for the coupling constants in your energy function. That will depend on some parameters that we put into the functional form. Again, this is something you guess. And so maybe there are not enough parameters here. Maybe you didn't put enough parameters here to absorb all the rates that were in the underlying system. And then the answer would be no. Yeah. So that's the comparison, is a fine scale master equation. This is the form for reaction networks with diffusion. And the coarse scale is going to be an energy function with time-varying coupling constants, not constant anymore. And then we have to invent some basis functions and some kind of form to optimize. The criteria for doing that is basically to compare the time evolution of the moments that you care about. And here's the lasso parameter. So that's what gave this older result, a few years old. The main drawback of this model is, we are doing model reduction from a fine scale system to a reduced model on some observables, very limited set of observables, much smaller than the configuration down here. The fine scale model is spatial, and the coarse scale model that I showed you is. So the new generalization is to allow the coarse scale model to be spatial. So now we need an energy function that has something like those coupling constants in it that are no longer constant, and some choice of how things interact. But it's got to consider where the particles are. So it's got to be a function of all the positions and maybe all the types of the particles, taken k equals 1 at a time for a mean field theory-like approximation in which you have a sum of energies, 1 per particle, so it's product of probabilities. But also k equals 2 would give you 2 particle potentials, and then you cut that off at some level. We chose 3 in some of the examples that I have to show. So again, we want to approximate the master equation by a time-varying Boltzmann. At any given moment, the Boltzmann distribution is a solution to a maximum entropy thing. Given moments of observables. So those are the ingredients that come into this slightly generalized problem formulation, where we have, again, an objective function. This one is a KL divergence between coarse scale and fine scale probability distributions, and a constraint, which is what's the form of the coarse scale, and an assumption that the potentials, k particle potentials here, obey some kind of dynamics, which is a functional that we don't know, and there should not be a dot there. I just did that. I made this mistake yesterday, so there's no dot there. It's a functional of the current values of all the potentials. then so here's here's a function, here's a functional, and what we have is a functional of a functional. And so abstractly, we want to vary this sort of action with respect to these unknown functionals and optimize that. Of course, we'll have to fit it all on a computer, so we have to drop down first to functions, from functionals to unknown functionals to unknown functions, then to unknown parameters, and optimize some actual parameters. But this is an encompassing kind of framework. So just formally, we do use the chain rule and find out that we need to find ds d nu and d nu df, and those are two different calculations. Ds d nu is easy. That is going to be the usual thing that always appears in these kinds of algorithms, which is the moment of the things that you care about in the fine scale that you can measure in a big simulation, and the moment according to your reduced model that now is hopefully a smaller simulation or something you can do analytically. The hard part is sort of d nu df. One way to parameterize this f is to have some function that just depends on what the value of nu is at a point. And then we've got reaction diffusion problems, so we ought to put in diffusion maybe as so to allow things to communicate with their neighbors. But this is in an exponential, so we would know the form of diffusion to use. And so the result then is a PDE constrained optimization problem. We want to minimize this subject to the PDEs that now govern d nu df. To get it all the way down to individual numerical parameters, here's an example, and I'm skipping several steps that are described in this paper from last summer. Here we have a mutual annihilation and diffusion and production reaction network, and we put it on a lattice and took the kind of sparse occupancy question, sparse occupancy limit, in which the partition function at any moment is an easy model, and for each type of particle, but the coupling constants are varying according to the kind of differential equation that I showed before. Here are the capital F's that say, as a function of the other coupling constants, how does this one change? So these are the learned ones, and initially, before you know anything, then the means predicted by the learned model are different from the learned model are different from those that we're trying to match, and at the end it learns. And the algorithm is a very that you derive is always comes out to be some kind of variation of the 1985 or so Boltzmann machine learning algorithm, which would be what you were doing if there was no dynamics. there is basically a wake phase and a sleep phase, and there's a partial differential equation solution phase interleaved. So you compare, you solve this PDE to propagate the error. You have to propagate it, and then you compare the moments, and if the moments are all matched, then your parameters won't move, but otherwise they will move.
Is there a place I can put in like a prior on the smoothness of my dynamic term?
Mm-hmm. Yes. That is the parameterization of F, the left-hand side of the differential equation for the potential particle potentials nu. So depending on how you parameterize it, That will determine the continuity of F. Later on, a little bit later on, we're using a finite element method to define F. We're not doing that right here. And then you can choose your basis elements for F and to include whatever level of continuity you wanted. We made it C1, continuous in the function but not in the derivatives. But you could make a different choice.
And so in practice, like, I could also go to each time point and I could just say, like, screw my dynamics, I'm just going to train
right.
the model at each time.
Right.
And then I'll probably get something, like, I could piece that together numerically and get something that's wildly discontinuous or something.
You could. And we started out by doing exactly that the first time out, and we saw that it was much more continuous and than we thought it would be. And that's what gave us the go-ahead to make differential equations for those moments. But that was in a particular case, and your case could be different. And if you don't like the discontinuity, there are various machine learning kinds of tricks that you could do to put in, you know, hidden units, which we'll discuss momentarily, and that might sort of ameliorate things. sort of more recent approach that we used was to map this onto. So the numerical work here involved leveraging the fact that it was an easing model, and the first round of experiments just used the analytic solution for one-dimensional easing model in order to invert the Boltzmann distribution, you know, go from moments to coupling constants rather than the other way around. But you can't do that in general. So here's an approach more recently that uses restricted Boltzmann machines as discovered and advocated by Jeff Hinton and his many collaborators to solve this kind of problem. And so there's a joint, there's an architecture in which the state variables that you're trying to get dynamics on, instead of coupling with each other, they can couple with a layer of hidden units, and which you can couple back, and you can solve in alternating phases. There is a partial differential equation for the unknown parameters, the partial differential equation for the coupling constants that are now coupling variables. And there's an adjoint partial differential equation, which instead of having an initial condition, has a final condition. And that's what this is. So you derive that, and then you have to solve that backwards in time. And then when you do all that, you get a gradient that tells you how to move the current model. And then you do that until the current model stops moving. And here, for example, is the difference between a easing model with next nearest neighbor interactions and everything visible versus this restricted Boltzmann machine idea where you've got visible units that are ones that are making your predictions for the time course and hidden units, which are, you know, not part of the original physics or biology of your problem. You put them in, but they allow neighbor-neighbor connection and efficient algorithms, and in fact, better learning. So I'll try to show that here. This one was, I forget which little model it was, and there's another little reaction network, and here it is. Fratricide among neighbors and diffusion. And here are the learned Fs, now as a function of three parameters, because there's there are one particle, two particle, and three particle potentials now. this is the visible only, and this is visible with hidden units. You can see this is sort of more structured looking evolution in parameter space. But more importantly, maybe the error goes down with learning much better.
But you have more parameters too, right?
No, it's about the same. We tried to make them about the same, because here you have next nearest neighbor parameters as well as nearest neighbor's parameters, so it's roughly the same. Yeah. A more challenging but still small network, the small reaction network, is the Rossler-Williamowski oscillator, which when treated deterministically can be chaotic in some parameter regime, so in principle it has both stochastics and chaos. And this is what that does at the fine scale. It can have kind of spatial waves sweeping through and oscillation among the three different particle types. But you can also learn these coupling, these functions for evolving the coupling constants. And in the paper, we argue that that there are sort of intuitive reasons why the hidden units are better. Basically, what the hidden units let you do is pick. You're necessarily doing some kind of moment closure. You know, we have parameters control the first three moments, but they depend on the fourth moment. So you're doing some kind of moment closure by picking the Fs. What the hidden units let you do is have the moment closure scheme being evolved as part of the learning. And so you can't have enough dynamic variables to control all the moments, and the hidden units will learn which ones to pick. And here is performance on first moment and second moment, and a typical configuration, and here what all the hidden units are doing for just one individual trajectory of this system. So that is part one. If there are any more questions about that, it's be a good time for it. Yeah.
Could you just explain a little more exactly what's
on this?
So Rossler has three dynamic variables.
Right.
If I remember correctly.
Yes.
Right? So it's three first order differential equations.
No, it's a stochastic model. If you did the do a mean field theory on it, then you get three differential equations.
So it's not the Rossler oscillator, it's Rossler oscillator with noise.
Right. With just the same reaction network translated into a stochastic reaction. The exact same network.
Good enough, very well. And the data you're looking at is...
The simulation outputs from that.
So what does the network, your learning network, taking as an input?
Configurations.
The whole trajectory?
Yeah, right. Sample. You can sample it.
Time.
Yes.
So three numbers at a given time, discretized.
Multiplied by space. So it's okay. a 10 by 10 by 10 cube. So it's a lot. It's a lot of data that you get to sample because you have a simulation of it.
Sorry. So this is a bunch of Rossler oscillators in space.
By diffusion. Yeah, right.
Okay, so we just increased the dimensionality by sort of a lot.
Huge amount, yes.
Very good. So now we're feeding in this three numbers. So this is on the torus, are there boundary conditions?
Boundary conditions are periodic.
Okay, so we're in the torus.
So you just get to specify an initial condition and let her rip.
Okay. And so how much data do we need to train the network? So how many nodes are in the network, if I ask?
Yes, you may certainly ask that. too bad I didn't draw the network. It's very small. It's, again, very, very small. I think there's chalk here. It is... A, B, C, X, Y, Z, and connection strengths and biases, something very small like this, just parameters for all those interactions. Times space, so you have the same thing going on at all positions, and these spatial interactions are subsumed by these hidden units. So B at one lattice point can interact with B at another, at a neighboring lattice point by means of the intervening X that's sitting at the very middle of the cube of those things. And this is using a finite element approximation of the of these functions F.
So are you using the knowledge that your local that you have three local degrees of freedom?
No, that's we've turned it from three into six, but the three are original ones are called the visible units, and they're the ones you read out. So they don't actually get, and the algorithm knows they're different from the hidden units, as is typical for a neural net training paradigm or restricted bulk machine, because there's no error on the moments going into the hidden units. They do whatever they want in order to help the visible units reduce their moment differences. And that's how, as I said, the hidden units can sort of decide which degrees of freedom to capture from the higher moments that can't be preserved in the three moments that we're tracking.
Okay, so I'm still not sure I understand what level of knowledge about the system that you're trying to describe actually goes into the design.
Very little.
Let me ask a question differently.
Yeah.
Suppose you have these three dynamic variables, these trajectories in 3D.
Yeah.
But you don't tell me that this is what you do. And instead, you embed this in additional 10 dimensions with your stochastic noise, basically doing nothing. And, don't give me this problem because I don't know how to solve it. But I'm going to give you that problem. So I'm going to take your Russell oscillator, and we'll decorate it with 20 irrelevant fluctuating variables.
Oh, thank you.
What will you do?
Not knowing which we don't know which ones are irrelevant, right? Okay.
No, you'll have to pay extra for that.
One would hope that when we make a corresponding architecture, you're going to find out that when driven by moments in order to make the visible units that you care about do the right thing, that there are going to be a lot of zero connections coming out, and extra variables will be dropped out. We haven't tried that experiment, but that's a typical thing. If you put in a lasso penalty term, you can often get something like that to happen in machine learning algorithms of this nature.
But isn't that really essential for any approach like that being useful? Isn't that the thing to test?
Well, it may be the second thing to test.
This learning algorithm can actually discover a hidden structure, because structure is always hidden.
So
I already know the structure,
right?
But I don't need a machine.
You need the machine so that you can go fast. So you, but you're asking for the other function that I attribute to model reduction, which is better understanding, and that would be great. And I expect that this is a way to do it, but we haven't demonstrated that. We have demonstrated that you get a reduced model that you could then scale up and run much better.
So I mean, you just said that the point of this is to go fast, because obviously you can run your whole very complex model.
Right.
Because that gave you the data for this. So
right.
What level of fast, and what does that actually let? What's the advantage of going fast? What does that let you do?
Well, I don't know. It's many orders of magnitude faster. I don't remember.
Okay, that's fine.
Six or four or something like that. Yeah.
So maybe based off sort of Boris's question, we have some. We can make some guesses you have some model, and maybe you have some noise or something that's not relevant. And we would maybe expect that if we like coarse grain in time, we can tell some difference between the like do you get anything by coarse graining in time and looking at the with the lasso parameter or something and looking at which connections die?
Coarse graining in time. We have a continuous time model, both at the fine scale and the coarse scale, or at the fine scale.
Oh, sorry, maybe coarse graining or learning in time. So like if I only took every other time point or something,
yes,
then maybe I would expect some of my parameters to change because of that coarse graining?
I'm not sure. I'm not quite sure what you're aiming at.
You can try this on like a simple diffusion model.
Yes.
And then like add terms that you know don't matter as you coarse grain in time.
Right.
And see if they die.
Again, you can certainly do that. I would expect typical machine learning results, which are often quite good, but sometimes you have to take an ensemble of runs. Yeah.
I think one way you could address Boris's problem, at least in the case where your roster was periodic, is
yes,
that if you look at the conditional distributions on phase, they're very close to being multivariate normal.
Uh-huh.
And so if you added this, Boris's redundant variables, you would see it in the covariance structure. So if you've got lots of data and you can construct that distribution, you would be able to see which variables are, you know, which ones are relevant and which aren't.
Right.
So that would allow you to see your three variables. I don't know how it would work with it when it's chaotic, but that should work,
yeah,
when it's periodic.
Right. Well,
what do you actually
there are many games that you could play that are typically done in machine learning that are done by varying this architecture, and we should do them now that we have a method. Okay. So thank you for the idea. since I hypothesized that this will be good not only for going fast, scaling up and going fast, but also for, as Boris suggested, revealing hidden structure by looking at these, for example, at what these hidden variables do, then this is something that we should do a lot, is find model reduction maps, and then do that over and over, and in interplay with human intuition, and create model stacks that go from a sort of comprehensive kitchen sink simulation at the bottom through various simplifications that are only conditionally justified depending on the values of parameters, to ultimately an analysis at the top. And so this is the kind of the picture that I think will be enormously helpful when we have automation like this. It requires lots of computing to do each reduction and to do the many different reductions that will be required for different values of parameters. But a good news is we have lots of computing available. So, end of part one. part two is dynamic structures, by which I mean spatially embedded graphs with labels that tell you something important about your biological system. Here it's the neighborhood relationships between cells in a shoot apical meristem, approximated as a Voronoi diagram. It's a slightly better approximation if you use a power diagram, as was suggested. And you know, this is the kind of spatially embedded graph that we have for cell-centered biomechanical models and for vertex models with biomechanics on the edges. That's one example. And you know, we saw many, many beautiful images. Here's an old one of such spatially embedded networks of cells in a tissue and what they do. Here are some more examples. Just show this one of the. What I'll actually talk about is microtubule component of cytoskeleton, but there are all these other dynamically structured, spatially embedded graphs, including even adaptive meshes for partial differential equation solving. So here's the microtubule network dynamics that is happening in the Arabidopsis petiole cells, and important to understand the dynamics and to understand how it varies under mutants. And one of the applications with my collaborator Elliot Meyerowitz for this kind of dynamics is to understand the possible role of stress in sheet-apical meristem patterning. And that's still hypothetical. So if you look at these kinds of movies, what some things that are classically observed are, here is, this one is easy to describe. Here's a microtubule treadmilling along, adding material at plus end, subtracting material at minus end, maybe. Anyway, it's adding material at some end. And then it encounters another microtubule. It's a these are cortical microtubules. They're in a confined space as kind of some kind of intersection. And in this case, the state of the end of the microtubule changes into the catastrophe state, and it more rapidly depolymerizes. On the other, and that happens again here, but here the microtubule tries again and eventually bundles. So here are some of the local graph dynamics that would be nice to get good at making models for. And there are modeling packages for this kind of thing. François Nedelec has one. My former PhD student, Dustin Maurer, got some help from François on you know, making a simple model that showed the behaviors that I just mentioned. But what I'm after is a modeling language that lets you specify this kind of thing at a very high level and manipulate the expressions in the language and make theories for it of maybe model reduction of the sort that I showed you before. And for that, we need to really understand what are the meanings of all of the expressions in a language like this. Here's a plus end at a given position with a given orientation, and it's polymerizing. And when it polymerizes enough, then you can declare a new subunit, a new segment of a microtubule has in discrete approximation has been formed, and the old one has become an interior one, and the new one has some new parameters. And then there's a propensity per unit time for this to happen, in which says that the new one has to be right nearby the old one, according to a standard length and according to the orientation that the old one had. Whether it grows or not depends on whether there's any tubulin to be had. The orientation can change a little bit, and so on. And there's a similar, so treadmilling is these two rules in a stochastic parameterized graph grammar. It's not the only kind. then the bundling or zippering that I showed you, here's an intruding plus end on a bunch of, crashing into a bunch of interior nodes of a different one. And what can happen is three things, but one of them is that you can form a junction. And that's the new stable structure there. And, you know, make up other rules that, for example, is actually N-type reversal is possible. here are the three things that could happen in when a collision happens in the cortical microtubule: zippering or bundling, crossover, and induced catastrophe. We saw these two in images. And here are their expressions, a possible way to express them in terms of, you know, graph in, graph out, many labels on the nodes of the graphs, and a propensity function. So this is a very general framework. In fact, it's general. It is a straight generalization of our previous dynamical grammars, which were for, you know, molecules with parameterized state variables. And in that case, we generalize to include differential equations. And so here, these two treadmilling rules, growing and retracting, if that happens a lot, then one might like to simply have a differential equation for how the ends of the microtubule move with occasional interruptions from these other graph events. And so here's treadmilling written out in terms of differential equations for the position of the plus end, the position of the minus end, and the length of the interior. So it's now got differential equations intermixed with discrete rules. And here are the discrete rules as before. This kind of model we previously actually implemented in Mathematica, so you could have this kind of high-level description, but without this nice graph description. It was a textual description instead. And we didn't have the semantics that I'm about to show you. So what is the meaning of each of these kinds of rules? Well, for a if we don't have graphs, if we just have pure chemicals, chemical elements or molecules, molecular species, then there's the Doyle-Polletti formalism that lets you define what each rule does. It is an operator that destroys the incoming chemical species and creates the outgoing one, all with the right stoichiometries. And if two such rules fire in succession, this is the off-diagonal part, by the way. There's also an on-diagonal part that conserves probability. If two such rules fire in succession, then that's equivalent to a sum over other rules that are given by these expressions. So there's the idea of an algebra. You take a product of the time evolution operators, you can turn it into a sum. Likewise, you can get a Lie algebra, which is looking at the commutators, and then you get a Lie algebra of a chemical reaction network. And there's potentially even an analog of a geometry for that. What we want now, and that is the framework that we used originally to derive the previous part of the talk that I showed you. We used the Doyle-Polletti formalism to derive model correction. So now we want the same thing for graphs. Well, first, we need the generalization to particles having parameters, because graphs are going to have labels, and that's straightforward. And that mean at that point you can put in differential equation rules as well, and that's previous decades' work to describe all that. Now we want things like this, where the plus end of a microtubule becomes an interior node, and a new plus end is added of a segment of a microtubule. And so we again want to destroy the incoming graphs and create label graphs, and instantaneously thereafter create the outgoing label graphs. And you may want to integrate over some of your labels, but not all of them. But the algebra is different. There's these are now presence or absence. You either have this node or not. You either have this link or not. So they're little 2x2 matrices, a boatload of them, and so they have a slightly different algebra. The idea is you create all the links. You create all the nodes and destroy all the incoming nodes and their labels. Destroy all the links. Create them. There's an algebra. How does it work? In the microtubule case, here is the operator, the off-diagonal part of the operator for this graph, and here it is for minus n retraction, the off-diagonal part, and we can compute the commutator, and you can see, sensibly, that for the most part, they commute. They only don't commute when there are no interior nodes and the two ends are interfering with each other. And then the interference is basically a relabeling. And so under some circumstances, that relabeling may be equivalent to the identity operator, and then the time evolution operator, where you subtract the diagonal parts, will be zero, so nothing will happen. But the equivalence here requires some work. It requires permutation invariance over labels, and also, in this case, it requires that no other rule in your grammar is making syntactically incorrect microtubules. For example, microtubules with a minus end, and then an interior node after it, and then also an interior node in front of it. That would be bad. That could result in this equivalence failing. So it's a bed of roses, but there are still some thorns on those roses that are kind of model specific. Here's a commutator of here's the growth, end growth, and bundling rule with a more complicated operator, and we can compute the commutator of that. It's a good thing to do, and there's an expected part, which is that if you grow and then bundle, then you may get a longer thing dangling off of the junction point. There are some unexpected things. If the two ends get close to each other, which shouldn't happen very often, then then you can get this commutator here, which looks a little different. And you can also get, and on the other hand, you can also grow and then connect back to yourself. And this would happen all the time unless the propensity functions, as I showed you, have a bending term, which they should, saying that microtubules are really quite stiff and don't like to turn around on a dime like that. And then this would be rare. So both of these things could be rare, and you could design your algorithm to either ignore them or to come back and correct for them very occasionally. So there's all kinds of operator splitting algorithms that are possible to create when you know the algebra. And you can even create them, but if you want to analyze their error, then you should know the algebra. So a typical thing to do with these kind of discrete events is you interleave the events of different types. So we could do a whole bunch of treadmilling and then an occasional occasionally check whether a junction needed to be formed. And that's justified by the fact that this approaches the right limit, the exponential of the whole operator, but there's an error term that depends on basically the commutator of those two things. The operator expression that I try to use a lot is this one, the time-ordered product expression, from which you can derive the classic Gillespie algorithm for stochastic chemical reaction network simulation, and that's what we used in our previous plenum implementation in Mathematica, this kind of thing. And in general, the expression to look at for how commutators enter in is the Campbell-Baker-Hausdorff formula, which lets you derive these other operator-splitting algorithms or analyze the error in them. So, yes? Time.
1 hour mark. So.
Okay, thank you. I am crashing on towards the end, but
yeah,
thank you for the
logical conclusion. Thank you.
right. So the total time is 10:15. Is that correct?
Well, no. Just try to bring us to a synthetic understanding, please.
Okay. A little bit more analysis, and then on to the synthesis, of which there will be a lot. So now we need the algebra for these graph grammars in general, for all those reasons. And this is a calculation that has bedeviled me for a while.
It's bedeviling us.
and I only showed you the beginning of it here. But anyway, you multiply the two expressions of this sort that I showed, and then try to commute everything. And it's clear that you can commute all the creation operators to the left, and all the annihilation operators to the right. But do you get another graph grammar term is the issue. And so this general form does reproduce itself under this, and that's published recently. But it's a little bit too broad. It's a bigger algebra in which the graph grammar algebra is embedded. What we want is this, that you get a sum of graph grammars, graph grammar rules out. And so and the main complication is actually dangling edges. When you remove a node as part of your graph grammar operation, that node may have had edges. You didn't have to name them because you couldn't know what they were in writing out the rule, and yet they have to be eliminated, and they could be anywhere. That's the real difficulty. Wow, I'm such powerful. Sorry. So here it is, I think, and I hope to post a preprint within a few weeks that will show the proof of this. The product of two graph grammar rules is given by a sum of new graph grammar rules in which you look for all of the subgraphs that are common to the output of the first one, labeled subgraphs for common to the output of the first one and the input of the second one, that have maximal edges subject to those conditions, and you consider all the automorphisms and some of them too. And then you construct the input of the new resulting graph by taking the first graph's input and the second graph's input minus the shared graph, and likewise with the output. And you can and then there's some there's a lot of details to that, but it's basically of this form. So now there is such an algebra. And furthermore, it reproduces the commutators that I showed you before that were especially computed. There's a competing approach that I will mention super briefly now, which is the double push-out approach that works for adhesive categories, and it's all beautifully laid out here. If you speak category theory, you're golden. You can find, not the commutator, they didn't do that, but you can find when the commutator is zero, which is also interesting. Now, what we're trying to do as a result of this is to create some kind of new piece of software that will analyze an incoming grammar symbolically and reduce it to a common form that has only a few kinds of rules in it, like these rules would be enough, and then put it on a big machine. And we haven't done that yet, but here's a big machine. the Summit machine, you know, this is what we should be doing biology on, I think, because this and you know, similar machines that are upcoming, because we really have not a huge number of species when you consider spatial distributions and biomechanics and so on, and it's just inevitable that we're going to want to scale up the size of the simulation as well. So how could you do that? Well, here's a code that's being developed now in the Department of Energy for particle simulation, for the back end of particle simulation. And this is performance results on plasma physics. So here's before optimization, here's hand optimization, and here's optimization done in a week or two by the Kibana team. And they could get just as well, just as good, or even better than the best optimization known on this big plasma simulation. So Kibana can be fast. It's a good back-end code for particle simulation. And here is our beginning of trying to do this for the graph, microtubules of graph rewrite rules. It's named after a geological formation, a volcanic one, near Los Alamos, New Mexico, where I studied this stuff. And here's the sort of the first light of the simulator showing growing microtubules and even a little bit of the junction formation. That's as far as we've got so far. So it runs. it requires, you do everything by hand right now. But that's a so now I need to skip. That's a potential back end for all of these graph dynamic graph grammar rules models. I'm going to skip the part about going to higher level above graph grammar. If you've got graph grammars, then you can implement transformations of cell complexes and potentially stratified spaces as well. And one thing that you may need is the ability to take limits of graphs. So the concept of a graph limit is if you have some kind of a limiting process that refines your mesh, and that's actually describable also in terms of graph grammars, but not the ones for your dynamics, then you have the, you know, we're trying to create prolongation maps that relate the nodes in one layer to the nodes in one layer, the nodes in the next layer, and thereby create a single structure that has a limit. And in order to do that, we want to find maps between the layers that reproduce the diffusion operator. And here's a method for doing that. We have one paper, and we're working on a second paper that computes good maps by minimizing this graph-graph distance and this distance roughly obeys the triangle inequality, depending on how you do it, either exactly or roughly. And most importantly, it can define these graph limits, or it looks like it can define these graph limits. So here are four different graph limits. As you increase the size, you look at these distances, and the distances on the diagonal are in a different scale. They're much smaller, and they decrease as the size of the thing gets bigger and bigger. So these series of graphs are, according to this distance measure, approaching a limit. That's the idea. And it's a different numerical realization of an idea by Laszlo Lovach, who's one of the most famous graph theorists in the world. he has a different name for it. So now to come back to assuming that we can do these things, what is the what is the big picture? As I advertised before, I think the key data type for bringing serious artificial intelligence help into the field, maybe you think you don't need that help, but I think we do. A key data structure is not an individual model, but a stack of models that are related by reductions that are conditional, depending on parameters, depending on all kinds of things. And these models can have a series of, they all need to be represented in some kind of algebraic way so they can manipulate them in the computer. So think computer algebra for that. But they can represent all these different kinds of systems of increasing generality, from pure stochastic chemical reaction networks to these parameterized ones that can allow you to have differential equations as well. And then what I argued for extensively is graph grammar rewrite rules and how those let you do create and represent and potentially numerically solve models with dynamic structure, dynamic spatially embedded graphs with labels that let you have a lot of different kinds of components of a cytoskeleton, for example. But then if you take the limit, take a resolution limit of these things, then you can get back to meshes and support differential equations on various structures, including cell complexes and the stratified spaces, as I think needed for biology. And at that point, we have something that is, biologically universal. You can describe all the models that you want. And then there are various nicenesses that it'd be just nice to have that are typical for modeling language, like subroutines and type inheritance and so on. So given that that's the goal, what we need is some kind of architecture for for dealing with these interlevel mappings. They're the central thing, I think. And what I showed is that they can be optimized and learned only for one type of mapping, the dynamic Boltzmann distribution, and I gave you a list of many other kinds that haven't been computerized like this before. But why not? And you can specify model reductions often change the type of mathematical model from stochastic to deterministic, or the other way around, or from discrete time, continuous time, and so on. So something so in order to support model reductions in general, then we need something that is biologically universal, and these dynamical graph grammars are an example of something like that, especially if you add in graph limits. They're not the only way, but the semantics that I showed you, the operator algebra semantics, is going to be essentially equivalent, I think. The language might be quite different. And I showed some test cases of that. And now, how do we curate these kinds of this kind of knowledge about how to reduce models, how to keep track of their semantics, how to translate biological knowledge and physical knowledge into them? That's the last slide before the conclusion, which is here's the proposed architecture for curating these mappings. And the nodes in this architecture, so this is a huge graph. It's got, I guess you can't really read it, science, mathematics, computing, and modeling as its top-level nodes. You can have processes, objects, and computer algebra-like expressions in each of those things. And then there's a hierarchy of spatial composition, specialization, and so on. And at every node in that huge graph, there's going to be a language. If you have a new modeling language, there's going to be a place to put it. And then there'll be a place to keep track of known mappings. What's the semantics of your new language? What are the known mappings that preserve semantics from one to another, from one language to another as you do this kind of mapping? What are the known implementations and their limitations? And what's the evidence that, can you prove a theorem that says that a given implementation is going to work? Or just provide numerical evidence based on previous simulations that it's going to work. You could even build sort of expert systems that go from statement like, I need a gene regulation network for Wuchel in the chute apical meristems. There's an example that I do need. And here's the wiring diagram of it. Now give me some equations according to, which standard translation, statistical, mechanical, or Hill functions, or what. And so you could curate and have easily available these kind of mappings from science to modeling as well. People have tried to do this kind of thing before, but they've been trying to do it on, like with SVML, from going straight from science computing, and they're missing, I think, these two worlds of mathematical specification and some of the expertise in modeling that could be captured this way. So that's the big vision that these, or a big vision that these two contributions would fit into. First one, a machine learning method for model reduction that does it in a fairly general way, not the most general way by any means. A specification of morphodynamic spatial structures, spatially embedded graphs, and easier things as well by these dynamical graph grammars, but more importantly by their operator semantics. Which has an algebra, and then you can express just about everything, any model that I've seen with these kinds of things, and I showed you a path to scalability. And then I advocated these other things, model stacks, declarative modeling languages, which most of our modeling languages have been. I had to skip over that part. And in this way, both parts of artificial intelligence, symbolic AI, which people think is passé and old-fashioned, except when they're using computer algebra systems, and numeric AI, which usually means machine learning, can be brought to bear in a big way on understanding these very complex biological systems at their own scale rather than a scale that is imposed by our lack of understanding.
Quarter to 11 in
the
main
center. And if anyone wants to help or talk, my office is at the top of the stairs this afternoon. Hi.
Yeah, good.
I'll go ask him. Okay.
Yes, I did.
Great. Okay, yeah. Do you have any time this afternoon? Early afternoon? Okay. So it might have to be this evening or tomorrow. Tomorrow's my last day. I could or early afternoon is good. Oh, you're free in the early afternoon. Okay, great. Right. Okay, all right. So 1 o'clock?
Oh, really?
Yeah, which is just at the top of the stairs, and then my name is on the door. That would be great. I really look forward to that.
Hi.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we were
so you're saying
you had mentioned something about how you were
going
to have two ends that were close together.
Yes, right.
You mean
plus end? Plus end, no, a plus end, in that case it's two plus ends that got close, so the plus end that's colliding happened to do it right near the front of the other microtubule. Then you get a kind of a different rule. And so the argument is that if you're worried about that, it doesn't happen very often. And so you might be able to make an algorithm that corrects for that, but doesn't have to spend very much.
I ran with CPU.
Detecting and correcting for it.
I ran to the beat. And then James ran off a couple more Ks. So, for example,
series of tuples.
How does biology handle situations?
Right. It might very well be different, and it might be that you want you have a hypothesis that could be expressed in terms of an extra rule. And then that rule, again, you know, it would be part of the algorithm. You'd be able to make predictions, at least about what your code should do. Yeah, you get the idea, since it's going to be a very high-level language, it should be very easy to add and subtract and edit rules in this model. And you know, we got that before in the previous implementation, but I had to know Mathematica very well, and you had to be willing to wait a long time for the simulations. So it's not impossible, but it could be done better. Yes, so that's your response to the experiment.
Right, totally. Maybe if it collides, now you see something new where it, I don't know.
Right. So, for example, one of the rules I skipped over, unfortunately, is the katana mediated severing rule, which is pretty easy, but super important.
Yes.
And so every time you know something new or suspect something new, then you can interrogate your model by adding a new rule to it or editing an old one and see what you think would happen. And the idea of this high-level language is to make that process more intuitive by having these kind of diagrams.
So I couldn't tell from your model, it seemed like they just got to each other, and then I couldn't.
Yeah, no, some of them went on.
Did and they go on?
Some of them, so there was a propensity to form a junction, and it was not 100%. So some of them went trucking right on. In fact, probably most of them went trucking right on over it. Which is, so I got two out of three outcomes, and the third one, catastrophe, is not in there right now, so that's why we didn't
get
it.
Okay, yeah.
Cool. Yeah.
So I wanted to come back to this question of, okay, so with this model, well, stacks of models, am I understanding correctly that your idea of a stack of models is, I guess the question is, what is a stack of models? What kind of models are you stacking?
Big ones at the bottom one, and finished analyses at the top, and in between it's your artistry and model building.
To translate into my understanding, would a stack of models be at the bottom, you've got your synapse interactions, and then you've got neurons, and then you've got a brain?
No, we're talking about a stack of, they could be changing spatial scale as well, but they could just be throwing out variables that you think aren't important as you go up. So it could be all at the microtubule level, and we have Katahn and severing in there, and we have maybe 15 rules in there, including that n polarity change rule. Maybe that just isn't important for my system.
So this is sort of your dimension reduction. So you've got the really complete model of every single rule, and then down to like your like seven.
All the way up to the top will be like Frank Ulicker's phase diagram for microtubule dynamics or something like that. And the point is that everything, every step along the way is formalized, so you can go back and simulate the heck out of it and see what are its limits of validity. If you got it all represented in the computer, then you can do more.
Then if you have these totally model reduction models, right, and they're much faster, then is the point that then you can combine those to get over bigger spatial scales or multiple.
Unfortunately, I didn't. That absolutely is one of the two. So, going fast and understanding are the two benefits. And I kind of.
I guess what the point of going. I mean, you can run the bottom one.
Yeah.
Why do you need to go fast?
Well, because when you want to scale up the size of your system, then you can't afford it anymore.
Right. So scaling. Okay. So scaling the size of the system. Yeah. That
right.
makes perfect sense.
Right.
Okay. Cool.
Right.
Okay.
So we can't. They can't run M cell. Simulations that are big enough right now, as an example.
So you need the model reduction when they can.
Yeah, right. That's why that lab is interested in doing the model reduction, because they're also interested in large scale brain architecture type questions, and they can't approach them at all.
Okay. Yeah. Cool. Yeah. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. I love you always have the great vision of how we're going to achieve things.
Yeah, it's my.
That's your college card. But
Achilles' heel, also.
I think we need that in this community.
Yeah.
We need the grandson.
I hope so.